Hi, I'm Tom Power. Welcome to Toy Harp, a podcast about bluegrass. This is the last episode of season two. Here from Nashville is my conversation with Allison Krauss.
I remember, you know, the first time I looked out in the audience and saw people singing words to our songs that only we had recorded. That was just a really crazy moment. Just never thought it'd end up being there. Never thought we'd hear back from Rounder. Yeah. Never thought we would hear from Rounder in the first place.
If this is your first time listening, you can hear full interviews with Jerry Douglas, Allison Brown, Bela Fleck, Larry Sparks, Jody Stecker, and so many more wherever you get your podcast. Thank you so much for listening. Later on.
Hello and welcome to Basic Folk, where we have honest conversations with folk musicians on the Bluegrass Situation Podcast Network. I'm Cindy Howes, and I host this darn podcast. Happy to have you here today. Hello, thank you for listening. Before we get into Viv and Riley, let's talk about staying in touch. Best way to do so is to sign up for our newsletter at the link in the show notes. Or you can go to basicfolk.com, click on the red sign up for the newsletter button. There you go. You've done it. It's a once a month newsletter that lets you know what's going on with your favorite little folk pod. We also are on social media. And let me tell you, my friend, we are on Instagram, mostly Facebook and TikTok at Basic Folk Pod. You can find us there. You can follow us there. We're also a listener supported podcast. We just wrapped up our fall fundraiser. It is the winter time officially. It's weird. We start in the fall and we end in the winter. That's just a thing that happens. If you did not get a chance to contribute, you can do so now. Basicfolk.com/donate. You can also go to the shop or the store. I can't remember what it's called on the website, but you can get a beanie there, a handmade beanie from my mom that has a little Basic Folk tag sewn on it. You can get that for $5 a month. And support this fabulous little folk podcast that we all just love so much. Okay, let's get into this. Vivian Leva and Riley Calcagno, known as Viv and Riley, dive deep into the nuances of old-time music, folk influences, and the process behind their album Imaginary People. The duo, who met at a music camp in Port Townsend, Washington, traced their roots from Riley's disciplined musical practices to Viv's intuitive approach. The two found inspiration from growing up in the Seattle area, listening to KEXP, that would be Riley, to living in Portland, Oregon, to their current home in Durham, North Carolina. Drawing on their experiences at fiddlers' conventions and music camps, Viv and Riley reflect on the transformative power of collaboration and the vibrant community that has shaped their unique sound in their duo, as well as their other band, The Onlys. As they share insights into their songwriting process, the episode unravels the intricate layers of Imaginary People, delving into the harmonious blend of indie roots and experimental production that defines their latest release. With a nod to their eclectic influences, including the supportive atmosphere of Durham, North Carolina, the duo discuss the evolution of their sound under the guidance of producer Alex Bingham from His Golden Messenger, who produced their latest album. Okay, we are going to take a listen to a song from Imaginary People. This is Kiger's Hill, and then we'll get to our conversation with the wonderful Viv and Riley on Basic Folk.
Watching.
right. So we were just talking. Viv and Riley are here. Hey, guys.
Hey.
Hi.
Hey, guys. I love you so much. Good to see you.
So good to see you.
Yes.
So, Riley, I just like cut you off, but I wanted you to say what you're saying on the record.
Well, yeah, here's for the public. Well, so I was just saying, Cindy took us in Pittsburgh. We just got off this like 3 month long album release tour, and
Pittsburgh was our first stop,
our very first stop, and it was kind of a random place to start, as you know. It was a Tuesday night in Pittsburgh, end of summer. You can see the scene, a hot day. But anyway. It was just a lonesome gig, and then y'all's presence there, you and Hootie, like, made us feel so much better. Like, and it was the start of our tour. It was our least well-attended show, but you guys were there, and we got through it all together.
And we enjoyed staying with you guys, so it made the whole thing not sad and kept us going for the rest of the tour.
Hell yeah. Oh my gosh. That show was so good, and... I remember like several times bringing it up afterwards and being like, these musicians who are pretty well known in their circle came and played in this town, and like seven people were there, and that's why I'm leaving.
And that's generous. That's generous. That's because most of those were employees. I would say it was about three non-employees.
But it was a great like first trial gig for us of the tour. Like we kind of got to try all our gear and also y'all were kind to us. So I just think there's that, I think a special thing about our little scene is you find friends along the way. I mean, maybe every scene's like this, but you find friends along the way and they make the maybe people you've never met before, but they make the like especially lonesome gigs less lonesome.
Yeah. Because I'm glad to hear that.
It can get rough if you're just alone in Pittsburgh.
I was trying to formulate a question for you guys.
Yeah.
When I was reading about your history and your first gig in Asheville, where there were like 15 people in a 200 person room. And I was like, kind of like that show in Pittsburgh, but I couldn't like come up with like a smart question. So I'm glad that we're addressing the elephant in the room.
Yeah.
It's not really an elephant in the room, but yeah. So I love your record, Imaginary People. And I'm excited to talk to you both about the recording process, but a little bit of background on you two, if that's all right, to start at the beginning.
Sure.
You're both from musical backgrounds. So can you each set the scene for what music like for you growing up and how you think that made you the musician you are now?
Yeah, I can do that. I grew up in Virginia, Lexington, Virginia, and... both my parents are musicians. They both sing and write songs, and my mom plays guitar and my dad plays fiddle. And
are they on a professional level?
Yes. Yeah. What they used to play professionally a lot. They were in different well-known old-time bands. And then my mom, you know, used to sing with like Hazel Dickens and Alice Gerard and those folks and Ginny Hawker. And then my parents were in a duo for many years called Jones and Leva, and they wrote songs and performed in that duo. But they always had other careers going at the same time, so they never did it full time. But, you know, they've played all – they've done, every time I tell them like where we're going and what we're doing, they're like, oh, we did that.
yeah.
We know that venue. So that's kind of cool. And I just grew up like around a lot of music, a lot of singing. I learned a lot of, you know, they would teach me songs and my dad would bring me on stage to guest perform with him and his bands starting from when I was like six or something. And really they just brought me along to a lot of fiddlers conventions, and so I think I was around music a lot and around a lot of people making music. I was not as interested, I think, like instrumentally, as like I didn't pick up the fiddle or banjo, but I was interested in singing and songwriting and eventually playing guitar to help me with that. But you know, lots of music, not just old time music. Listened to all sorts of music at our house.
Yeah. And I grew up in Seattle, so on the opposite coast. My dad was in the, my parents were music lovers. My dad is a musician. He was in the, like the Seattle experimental music scene, in the '80s and nineties. And then
he's probably got stories. Jeez.
Oh yeah.
I mean, your parents both probably have stories. Wow. Two different types of stories.
My mom managed a mime theater in Seattle in the '80s.
Yes, is, as one does.
That's the most Seattle in the '80s thing I can think of. And anyway, so, but then they found folk music, around, you know, a little bit before I was born, and my dad started playing mandolin and old time fiddle. And there's a scene of people, you know, they made their way east, or sorry, west. Directions are so hard. Made their way west. At some point, but spent a lot of time with old fiddlers, and there's a robust scene of those folks in Seattle. There was a square dance when I was growing up. When I was born, we started going, maybe a little bit before I was born, they started going to fiddlers conventions and stuff around the area. And then around that time I started asking for a fiddle, and they gave me a little toy fiddle. So I started kind of hammering on that, and I started taking violin lessons. I had a stress dream about playing the violin last night, but I won't bore y'all.
How'd it go? It
didn't go great for my performance in the dream. Mm-hmm. I like was really confident, and then as the performance approached, I started wondering if I could just play a fiddle tune. The premise was I was supposed to play a piece of Bach, but I hadn't played Bach in like 10 years.
Got it.
So it was really stressful. I was trying to like cram the notes, like, you know, looking at the sheet music, trying to memorize it. That was failing. Then I just said I'd read it off the sheet music, but it didn't sound good. And then my bow broke.
So, why do our brains try to kill us?
Yeah, mm-hmm. It was rough. But I got through it, just like I did play classical music for a while, hence the dream. So I got through all that, and now I'm back to just playing fiddle tunes.
The two of you met at a music camp in Port Townsend, Washington, and it sounds like you were only overlapping at this two-week camp for a few days, but like, sounds like also it was like immediately you hit it off. What was your initial connection like, and how do you still relate to that?
I feel like our initial connection was we just immediately started having fun together. And Riley was with his other bandmates, Sammy and Leo. And those three started with this band, The Onlys. And so I met them also at the same time that I met Riley. So it was kind of the four of us. I feel like we're just immediately started like running around the camp and playing music together and staying up late and singing songs. And from my perspective, at least, I didn't really have the same experience that they had growing up, which was like that they were all the same age and they were all into the same kind of music and were all like at similar like musical levels so that they could play together. And I didn't have that growing up, like with people my own age. So it just was really exciting for me to meet like three other people that were, you know, only months apart from me in age and like had very similar knowledge, like musical knowledge and tastes, and but also were just like really fun to hang out with. So it just, we all clicked very quickly, I think.
What were the other ages of the attendees of the camp?
Well, that was, you know, I laughed because I was thinking it was all old folks, but that was Voice Works, and there's a good young crew. But it wasn't people exactly our age. It's folks younger than us or like a little bit older than us. So that was a special thing, is like our band.
You guys like 18 when you met?
Yeah, we were 18.
We had all just graduated high school like that month.
And I remember watching Viv and her mom sing with Laurel Bliss in the Wheeler Theater there in Port Townsend. And it was just such beautiful singing. I'd become a fan of her mom's music, like she was talking about, in the years right before that. And it was really special to just hear their voices like resonate. I just remember being stricken by that. And then I just remember the sound that when we first jammed with Sammy and Leo, who are my old friends and bandmates, it was just and Nundy Forrest was there, our dear old friend. And I just remember that being like a really special sound and being really taken with like the sound that we all made together.
Cool. This is maybe the answer to this is no, but were there any differences in your musicality based on being from two different sides of the country?
What do you think?
Well, you grew up in Viv grew up in a really robust, I think of a really robust singing tradition. Like her parents went to go visit ballad singers and they could all sing like three-part harmonies and find the different parts all in on command, you know? And I came from this like really, really kind of vibrant fiddle world with the West Coast fiddle scene and grew up going to fiddle camps. And so I think we had slightly different perspectives on old time music in that way. I was trying to sing and I sang some in the onlys, but it wasn't what felt natural. And I didn't know how to like find a harmony part very well. And so that was something that we kind of like had to figure out.
Yeah, it was interesting working stuff up at the beginning. I feel like I was more interested in singing than, like I said, like I didn't play fiddle. Everybody else all played fiddle. And then there was just different repertoire. Like I feel like it took me years to really like get to know all of the West Coast fiddle tunes and like what chords go with them, because
it's a vibe.
It's a vibe. It's like they're great, great tunes that people play out there. But it, you know, my dad plays like Tommy Jarrell Round Peak tunes and like North Carolina tunes and Kentucky tunes. So it just was, so just different material. But that was exciting. Mm. Like, you know, oh, we both play old time music, but I don't know any of these tunes and they sound pretty and interesting. So,
But then the thing that really drew us together was that we were not only interested in the old time music that we were jamming on, but we had this sort of side interest in writing songs and arranging them. And
even I feel like we were all kind of willing to kind of cross over. Like we all were really comfortable and familiar with like old time music, but then we would do country songs, and you know, Nundy, who we were saying played with us, he's like a great country singer, so like you could bring in country and honky tonk music. And then also like Riley and I both, when we were teenagers, like wrote pop songs, and so we are down to like do original music that is kind of in neither of those worlds. And you know, so we weren't like, yeah, we were willing to like try different things at different times.
Mm. Man, okay. I'm also trying to like figure out exactly when you all were like becoming teenagers from 12 to, you know, 12 to 20. Was it like you were born in the late 90s?
Yeah, we were born in 98. So,
okay. So like your teen years would have been like the early 10s.
Yeah.
Right. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Or like we graduated
in 2016.
We graduated high school in 2016. Yeah.
Okay.
What do you think we were listening to?
Well, okay. So it's weird because when you were in high school, Spotify was like a big thing. And I actually would love to hear more about how you consumed popular music, because I don't think I've ever had the opportunity to like dig into this with people your age, you know, like for people of a certain age, it was like the radio. And then it was like, oh, I had somebody made me mixtapes. And then, you know, my generation had CDs and we had CD players in our car, and then Napster at the turn of the century. And then iTunes became a thing. And then it feels like the next big thing was Spotify and streaming. Mm-hmm. And people talk about how streaming is bad for art and bad for musicians. And I agree wholeheartedly. But the other side of that coin is that you have access to like whatever you want. And I just cannot imagine being a teenager in high school and being like, I can listen to anything I want. My friend used to live like across the street from the mall, which is close to the record store. And I'm like, wow, you can get music anytime you want.
I feel like we're maybe a tiny bit older than the people you really need to talk to about that phenomenon, because my formative musical, like when I was getting into music, my own music, my own iPod. It was an iPod and it was iTunes. And I remember buying Arcade Fire albums off iTunes. And
but which one were you buying?
Suburbs.
You weren't buying The Funeral. This, you buying The Suburbs. Yeah. Okay. So The Suburbs was like two albums after The Funeral.
And
okay,
I feel it's like just interesting I never got into that album. Like I spent $12.99 on it, but I never got into it.
On The Suburbs?
Yeah. I never got into it.
Don't sleep on Neon Bible. Except although Arcade Fire, people don't listen to that band anymore.
Mm. Yeah. I never did. I had the access to it.
I burned it in protest.
See,
you're ahead of your time, Riley.
I feel like my music consumption was very fragmented. Like it would be, yeah, like a lot of iTunes, and I would get like an iTunes gift card for Christmas, and then, but I personally like never committed to like a whole album. Like I'd be like, I have to like disperse this money, so I'd buy like one song from like a bunch
of
albums,
for your buck.
And then just like have it on shuffle all the time, which I just don't think is was a great move. It was either that or I would I did burn CDs still, and then I used Pandora. Was my streaming service.
We're kind of haunted though still by that era, because Viv in her MP3 download like one song at a time day somehow downloaded Steve Miller's band song Abracadabra, which is, if you think about it, it's AB, so it's the start of the alphabet.
It comes on every single time we get in the car.
Oh. So it's got
plug in my phone for music. It's Steve Miller, Abracadabra.
So
it's pretty terrible.
Mine is Bob Seger, Against the Wind.
Nice. Nice.
You think it's nice.
Oh, I believe it sucks.
It's not nice. It's kind of nice, but then you're like, okay.
But I do feel like I'm a bit broke.
It's haunting.
Like, I do still kind of feel like I have a bit of old man Spotify energy. Like, I can't figure out how to use it very well. Like, I'm not good at making playlists. And I don't know if it's just sort of like that I was too far in my dad's iTunes library. Like I wasn't weaned soon enough from my dad's iTunes library, or if it's like I'm just a little bit past the moment, or I don't feel like I use Spotify very savvily. So
okay,
I apologize that we're not
exactly
the people you need to talk to.
No, I was just talking to Nina DeVitri, who maybe is like a couple years older than you guys. And she was talking about having like access to her parents' iTunes library. So it all tracks.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I'll have to go talk to
the parents' iTunes library is where it's at.
It's really
even all roads lead to Riley's dad's iTunes library for us these days.
in middle school.
I guess I have to go talk to Nora Brown.
You need to talk to Nora Brown.
Yeah. Figure this out. Okay. Great. Nora Brown, if you're listening, I'm coming for you. The album Imaginary People has an openness to experimentation that I want to talk about a little bit later, but I want to get to how you got to this openness together. I think Viv said, we're both so open to other kinds of music and we have very similar taste and aesthetics. Where does that open-mindedness come from for each of you?
I think, I'd be curious to hear what you say, Viv. But for me, I mean, it's kind of connects to what we were talking about, like growing up in Seattle in the early 2010s. Like I was just, I was downloading, there was this radio station, KXP, and they had the free song of the day where you could download one MP3 of a day, and it'd be whatever it was, like that's what you'd get. And I remember that just opened me up to a lot of different kinds of music, I think. which is kind of cool, actually. No, I haven't thought
that
about
that. That radio station is so good.
Yeah, yeah,
it's still the greatest.
No more free songs, because every song is free now. But that is kind of a cool way to do it. It's like, well, if I can only have one song and someone else decides, like, it makes you love it. I remember I got one Head in the Heart song on from a free song, and I listened to it every day on the middle school school bus. But yeah, I think that was part of it. It's just like growing up, my dad was blaring old scratchy fiddle music in the next room, but I was listening to like some like Seattle hip hop, or like whatever they were giving me for free. and then I was practicing classical violin. So it was this odd mix that I think kept me on my toes a little bit. What about for you, Viv?
For me, I feel like I feel like I kind of have to be open to different ideas when we're thinking about, like, you know, producing a song or working something up, just because, like, I don't know, I feel like growing up I was encouraged to just to make whatever music felt like real or like was coming from a real place, and to like not worry about labels for it. And I feel like when I sit down to write music, it's just kind of like something different will come out every time, and it's not purposeful, but I think it just is. It's influenced by different things kind of unintentionally, and a song will just be what a song is, and it might require different things or might be inspired by different genres, but it's not like, I just have always tried to not be like, you have to write this in this style of music, like you have to write and sometimes it might be like, today I wrote a song that sounds old time, or today I wrote a song that sounds country, but it's just like whatever music feels right is like the music I want to make.
Yeah. Well, that brings me to my next question about, you have a very intuitive approach, and listening to your answer, it just sort of solidifies that maybe your open-mindedness comes from your intuition. So your approach is more intuitive, while Riley's education was more formalized, like Riley can read music. And that sounds like a really good balance. However, do you feel like those attributes are ever detrimental to your partnership?
I mean, I feel like we've just kind of had to figure out how to be ourselves in the collaboration. Like, and the good thing is that, like, while we did have different training or kind of upbringing in music, like I think more than most people, like we're pretty close to each other compared to like all the people in the world, like in terms of our approach, and plus I'm, you know, I never want to see a page of sheet music again, so I'm not wed to that in any way. What do you think, Viv?
I don't know. I feel like we don't have there's not that much, you know, there's not that much we like go head to head on or anything. I feel like we both make music similarly. I mean, Riley has more discipline than I do, I'll say that, which is like not a bad thing and is something that I probably resist a little bit, but can benefit from sometimes. Riley's, you know, he, as someone who played classical music and went to conservatory for several years in college, like he knows how to practice something, whereas I think I lean more towards, you just sing it, it'll be, you can do it.
But that's a difference.
But it's
that's a difference in what we can do, I feel like, because Viv is so consistent with like I'm more on the struggle bus in terms of like I have to practice and work on things and like learn my harmony parts and practice them. And Viv has this natural ease about her musicianship. Intuitive, I think, is the right word. It's like very intuitive, very natural. And I think that gives a lot of life to our collaboration because I'm someone who forces it, and sometimes it's good to force it. Sometimes it's good to grit it out. I think we benefit from that approach, but I think a lot of the heart of our duo comes from not forcing it and letting it kind of flow out, which is really Viv's strength.
The new record, Imaginary People, was produced by Alex Bingham of His Golden Messenger and recorded in the Durham area with Durham pals. You guys also live in Durham.
We do live in Durham. Yeah. Yes. It's so nice.
Riley said you live there because Viv put her finger on the map.
It was very random to begin with. We had really never been to Durham except for like 6 hours that we spent the night one time and then didn't see anything except for our friend's guest room. But
a classic touring musician thing where you only know the guest room in a, in a house.
But yeah, we really didn't know Durham, but had friends that lived there and were drawn to it. Just the idea of trying it out. And then we just lucked out and happened to get asked to house it for 6 months for free, or like for a house it, have a place to live for 6 months for free, which was a great trial period. So we
that's
we
awesome
just packed up from Portland, Oregon and moved to Durham. And then
can you find here. That situation for me in Portland, Maine?
I can do my best.
We're pretty good at finding okay. places to stay in Portland, Maine. So
okay, great. I'll let you know. Like we mentioned earlier, there was some cool experimentation and new sounds on the album, but there also were new friends being featured on the songs, and you two connected over music when you first met. Can you talk about what it's like to have music as a way to connect with new musicians who then become collaborators and then become friends?
It's such a good accelerator. We became aware of Alex through our Viv's kind of brother, not actual brother, but Sam Freibush, who also plays in His Gold Messenger, and my old friend too from before. We both knew Sam before we knew each other, and Sam connected with Alex, and we had a phone call and immediately hit it off, just kind of talking about the songs. But it's not to our credit. It's the kind of person that Al is. He just is like a connector and just a very thoughtful person. And I think that like working on the songs was like, it's like the best escape room ever. It's like, it's like you got to figure out your way to get, it's just it's a bonding experience. It's like, if young professionals in Raleigh could all be in recording projects with each other, they would be less axe throwing places and more recording studios.
Wow.
You know what I mean, though?
Yes.
Yeah, I feel like there was, you know, when we first met up with Al, like Riley said, we hadn't met him. And I was personally a little nervous just how it was going to go because especially for us, like coming from, we are like, so even though we're doing different things, we are so rooted in traditional music. And I think like really wanted to be understood in that way, like as that was something that mattered to us and like was going to be part of how we make music and make an album, even if it's not an old time record. And just the more we hung out with Alex and like talked about the music, like when you can see that you share, like that you share a similar musical perspective or you have like similar taste or ideas of like what you want to do and those are aligning, that's really exciting and like for me, a way to bond really closely with someone. Mm-hmm. Just being like, I not only really like this person, but I can trust their perspective and like that allows you to be vulnerable and try new things because you believe that like ultimately you have the same goal.
Mm-hmm.
That's so great.
One of the first time we got together with Al one time before we started making the record. And we stopped by the studio and we were touring with this song that's on the record. It's the last track. It's called Blackest Crow, and it's an old song from the Ozarks that I know from this great, I know my dad taught it to me, but he learned it from a great duo named Kim and Jim Lansford. And it's a song we've been doing live for like as long as we've been playing, almost as long as we've been playing as a duo. And it feels like an important song to me, but we've tried to record it a couple times. And the way we were doing it in our live shows was not translating in recorded form. And I think the other, so what I'm getting at is like the other element of finding a collaborator is not someone who, just that you trust, but someone that you trust when they bring a new idea that kind of disrupts your process, that you trust it might be a good one. Because Al, we started singing Blackest Crow and he started like fiddling with this box I had never seen before, like an MPC, which is like a sampling tool. And he had this little thing on his sampling tool that was just this like repetitive loop that really went with the banjo and like the things that were already in our version. And we slowed it down and like really changed it. And it was in the, like the first 25 minutes of collaboration. And so I think that was like the moment when I was like, oh, this is going to be really cool. This is going to push us, but in a way that I think is really special.
Cool. Okay, let's talk about this experimental sound. That's a good segue. And this is all thanks to Facebook, right?
Yes. Yeah, thank you, Mark Zuckerberg. You can have my...
Mark Z. So Facebook is where you bought an electric guitar and a drum set and started writing stuff in the basement.
Yeah.
That's where we're coming to you right now, right by the drum set.
Oh,
in our basement.
Live from the basement. What brought on this fun and unusual activity, and how did you each feel about stretching out your sounds in the early stages of these sessions?
I don't know why I was like, just, you know, you just get a craving for something new in your life.
I have a theory.
Soft serve. Sometimes you like soft serve.
Yeah, exactly.
I have a theory. I don't know if this is true, but we kind of started doing this during COVID especially. Mm-hmm. And I feel like in Portland and in Durham, throughout most of our summers, like most of our musical life is kind of taken over by fiddlers conventions and festivals, mm-hmm. and like old time, like big community gatherings where you're seeing all your friends, and like old time music is very communal and as you know, and community oriented. And I feel like with that not happening during COVID, I just think we were interested in, we just kind of were drawn to other kinds of music, listening and making it. I just feel like we didn't really do that much old time music during the pandemic. And then we're just like playing around with stuff that was fun to do, just the two of us, and like, interesting and just something new to mess around with that was like a little more chill, like that you didn't have to like rip a fiddle. You could just like, you know, Riley could just pluck an electric guitar or, I guess playing drums isn't that chill.
And I guess our roommate my roommate in Ohio, great songwriter named Sam Bailey, under the name Preacher and Daisy, he had a drum set, now that I'm recalling it. And he also had an electric guitar. And a lot of my early pandemic time was making this solo EP for actually a college class with the electric guitar and keyboards and stuff. So I think I had been wanting to have an electric guitar, but, you know, we were moving and it was just, I don't know, things were weird. And then got to Durham and it was like, wow, we can be creative again. And there's a robust Facebook marketplace scene in Cary, which is a town south of Durham.
But it's interesting how little I think it takes to inspire songwriting. Like I've talked about this in the past, like when people have asked me about like how I write songs, and like often it's very small things like that will bring a song out. Like if I've learned a new chord, like then that might be enough to like have a whole new song out of it because it's a new interesting sound. And yeah, I just feel like you weren't even playing the electric guitar like differently than how you like play acoustic guitar, but just having slightly different like a different sound coming out while you're doing the same thing on a different instrument, I feel like just results in, just new, like it just inspired, even if I don't even think the songwriting was that different.
No.
But it just was like something different that was interesting enough to like spur new songs.
Hmm. Okay. I have two more questions about experimentation and I think they should be their own questions. I want to know how your roots still came through in these experimental sessions. Like, was it easy to stray away from trad and old time, or did it like continue to just like bubble up, maybe even get in the way a little bit?
A lot of the songs that were like, that were, I think, referring to really seemed to come out like all in one piece, or mostly like, if I'm thinking about like the general and I think that's a testament to like the power of the, it's giving me such a skeptical look right now. I think that's a power, like what you were saying is like, it's a potent tool when you can change something up. What do you think?
But what do you think to the question?
Am I...
it's about old time and in old time music. So right. Get in the way.
Well, that's what I was getting. That was I thought I thank you for reminding me where I was going. I feel like it didn't get in the way because it was acting on its own. But I don't think you can separate yourself completely from your influences. Like, there's something about the storytelling. I think in your song Kiger's Hill, it's a ballad about going home. Like, it's not. It sounds really different. It sounds like a surf rock song in a way, but like it's a ballad about going to your home place, your old home place in Virginia. And I think you approach the storytelling not unlike the details that would be in a traditional song. Mm-hmm. Does that resonate to you?
Yeah, definitely. I don't feel, I think that there were moments that like, I would just notice that like Al would think it was funny maybe how we would like approach something just because he would be like, that's your background. Like, that's, you guys are so funny. Like,
there's that yodeling.
Or like that we would want to like be really close together to like record. Like, we wouldn't want to be isolated. We would like want to be able to buzz off each other vocally. Or, I have like a boom chuck rhythm thing that like probably, I think there were some songs like we didn't have that like rhythm on it that I play on most,
right.
Most of our songs but it didn't get in the way. It just was having to like come at it from a different direction. Like what Riley said for The Blackest Crow, like, okay, we know how we would just like do this song automatically if we were doing, you know, what we know and what feels comfortable, but like, how can we approach everything with like a slightly, with something different? Like what might be the main instrument besides banjo, or like, how can we make this all feel cohesive, but blend it all together? We brought it all, we did a fiddle tune on the record. Like, we weren't trying to like not touch traditional music. But we just didn't want everything to go into that category. We didn't want it to limit us, and I don't think that it did.
It kind of reminds me, Viv, of we've been listening to this Iranian psych rock musician from years past, and it's funny because I put it on and I was playing it for my dad, and the first thing he said was like, "That's not psych rock. It sounds like I don't know Iranian music, but it sounds like Iranian traditional music to me, like how I would think about it." But he thinks like he's like pushing his boundaries drastically forward. And I feel like it creates this really interesting mix where it's like, it sounds like Iranian, like, psych rock.
Right.
I don't know.
And it's probably the similar thing with our record. Like, you know, Riley's still like, you still play the instruments you play in the style that you like learned it in. So like, you're still going to hear a country fiddle part on like the title track. You know, even if there's other production things, like that core is still on it. But
you can't escape your roots. You know, you can't outrun who you are.
Right. Boom.
A message to you all listening.
Riley, you said, I think we were trying to make music that felt right to us. We wanted to follow each song where it wanted to go. So let's get a little bit more heady here because we were already there. How did you know when the songs felt right? And when did you know to stop stretching with a song?
We were just on the on a little tour with a band called Blind Pilot. Great folks. And they're about to go into the studio to make a new record for the first time in a while. And one thing they were saying is that they tried to limit their time, that they didn't have, that they didn't want to give themselves so much time that they could overthink stuff. And for them, you know, they're a really successful band, like, and they also came up in a time when, like, there was a lot more money in the music scene, in my estimation, in those lucrative iTunes days. But I think, you know, they've probably spent like months working on records before, and this time they're doing it in 2 weeks. And they said they did that to, like I said, like to not overthink things. And we don't live in the lucrative iTunes days. And so we just only had so much money. And so I feel like we didn't like try and retry things.
Yeah. Like, we actually recorded for the longest period of time that we ever had,
yeah,
which was 9 days.
Right. Yeah.
Like, I think that included practice, like 2 rehearsal days or something.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was like 7 days of recording and 2 days of rehearsals. And
it's pretty
like,
fast.
For us, like, we were like, oh, we're really giving ourselves time. But it at 9 days is still a really not that much time to get a full record done, especially when you're like working with people you haven't worked with before and they're like learning your songs. So I do think that we actually do well with like a time constraint, and that it's not something that we're like adding to over months and months, because I think you can really lose perspective. So it's kind of has to be like whatever you can naturally make in a week's time, basically. And yeah, so that parameter definitely helped. And then I think Al would, you know, push us in by, he had a lot of ideas, and we would try most of them. If it was like a new part or like a certain way of playing, in like playing something like that we wouldn't normally do. And I think we would try it, but I think we had pretty good instincts. If it was like really interesting and still felt true to us, we kept it. And if it just felt like that's not our, you know, that's not our aesthetic, or that's not like how we make music, then we would not keep it. I think we had a pretty good flow with like what, how much to try new things and how much when we knew to just like edit and say, no, this is good just as it is.
Viv, on creating the record, you say, I unlocked something. I think I let go of some fears in the process of making this record. How cool. That's great. How have you seen that reverberating out into your life?
That's such a good question. I think I'm still trying to learn from it, because it's easy to forget as you continue on doing other things. But I think like at the beginning of that project, it was really like scary for me to think about working like with someone totally new in a different genre. And we like kept talking about it, but then I would be like, oh, well, maybe we should just go where we went the last record. Like that went well. And we love Joelle, who made that record. He's great. But I, you know, what we decided ultimately like that we just need to try something new, and it could go well or it could not go well. And I think I am trying to bring that with me with other things, of like when to do what's comfortable and what you already know, and when you just need to like, yeah, let stuff go and not like worry what other people are going to think or if it's going to turn out perfectly, because then you end up with something probably more interesting, and you're not just trying to like recreate what you've already done. You're trying to like see what will happen by doing something new. So I'm trying to like bring that piece of uncertainty with me.
Cool. I'm also wondering, since you are such an intuitive player, and I've sort of like glommed on to this intuition thing, like how that has played into this new phase of your life where you've let go of some of the fear, but you have such good intuition. So it's strange to think that you were like, I don't know if we should do this. Like your intuition was wrong, or maybe it was fear that was taking over. Mm-hmm. But I don't know how that's hitting with you.
Yeah.
About following intuition and not being afraid.
Totally. I think it's like really very important, and something that, you know, even like being on tour the past 3 months, like playing shows, I'm like really want to keep with me, because even like playing these songs live, I was like kind of scared how people would like them, or like, I don't know, whether people who liked our old stuff would like these songs, or if they're translating. And I don't know. Yeah, I'm really trying to be better at just being like, well, do I like what I'm doing? Does this feel good for me? And like, that's what matters. And if I can like believe in and, you know, value what I'm doing, then it actually, it doesn't, like the other stuff doesn't matter. And probably people will, you know, enjoy it more. Like if I am enjoying what I'm doing.
Do you guys ever think about the fact that like making this record the way that you did is not only good for your own musicality and your own humanity, but it's also good for traditional music?
I think one thing that's been gratifying about making the record is being sort of surprised about who reaches out and likes it. And a lot of, you know, we did have this sort of complex. I don't think we were giving traditional music enough credit, probably, you know, and traditional musicians enough credit, because a lot of people who have texted me, like who really are resonating with the record, the new record, are like old fiddlers and, you know, our favorite old time musicians and people who, and so I think that like, I don't know if I could say that we're doing something good for tradition, but I think it's illuminated to me that our definition of what people are willing to go to or enjoy is not always what you're already doing. Sometimes you can lead people in another direction that they'll like. And I think that's sort of our job as musicians. It's not like I think that it can be a lot easier to be a musician who does the thing that's expected of you, you know, makes the album that is going to be easy to market and expect.
You know, will be like.
Yeah. The album that's like your last record, or like that did well. It's so much easier to make that kind of record. But I think part of our responsibility is to do what we want, and to show people that, and maybe they'll like it. Or maybe, you know, it'll be like Arcade Fire Suburbs and they'll buy it off iTunes and never listen to it.
Maybe.
And that's fine. Like, not everyone has to like everything. And
totally. And yeah, it's funny when, yeah, if someone's like, well, I liked your last record better. Well, that's totally.
Oh, musicians love that.
But it's fine. Then they can listen to that record. And it doesn't mean that, you know, I think there's kind of too much pressure in some ways, in like to like make like that this record, your next record, is like gonna be your, I don't know, like the best one yet or something like that. But yeah, I think that every project should be allowed to be different, if that's what the art, you know, the musician wants to do, and to like do whatever they're interested in at that time. And it's okay if like different people like different eras of their work, but I think it shouldn't like limit people for like what they want to be making.
It's like what we're saying in like 2,000 words, what Joni Mitchell said in that great preamble of the Circle Game live version, where she said, like, no one tells Van Gogh to paint A Starry Night again, man. And I love that. It's like, you don't want an artist to paint the exact same painting, because that would be a replica. And I don't think we're like great artists or something, but I do think it's interesting to like push it forward. And everything that you put out is just an offering. It's like, you don't have to take up just because someone offers something. It doesn't mean you have to take it or even care about it.
A theme on the album is growing up, bittersweet nostalgia. How are you each feeling about growing older?
I'm feeling good about it. I feel like this year has been a lot of big growth for me. And just, I feel like I'm learning a lot. I am learning about how to, just like how to live my life as an adult and try and make this career. And, but you know, it's been a long transition, I think, between like college and through all the, you know, just complicated stuff. And I think, yeah, your early 20s is definitely a transition period. And just, I personally feel like always being in between, like, you know, having an established life. I'm traveling, I'm meeting people, I am in some ways an adult, but then also feeling like I have, you know, no idea what I'm doing, and still like really, really like valuing like my parents' perspectives and like guidance of how to do things. And so I think like all those years of early 20s is like you're just being in between two, you know, multiple worlds and like different eras of your life, like your future self and your past self. And yeah, but now almost at the end of 25, I think I'm like, yeah, you're just growing every day.
I've been joking with friends lately because they say that like your brain finally like fully forms its frontal cortex.
The cerebral, yeah.
Frontal lobe. The frontal lobe, that's right. That's what I'm looking for. Anyway, yeah. I feel like I'm feeling that a little bit. It's like, it's not the edible is hitting, but like the frontal lobe is hitting a bit. and that feels kind of exciting. And it's also, there's a sadness to it too, to me, because it's like, because I feel like there's something really fun about your frontal lobe having not hit, having not dropped yet. It's like, you know, you're just doing stupid things and like, you know, getting on your bike and riding around without a helmet. And I don't know, just doing things that your fully formed frontal lobe will not approve of. I miss that a little bit, but maybe I'm giving myself, I think I'm probably giving myself too much credit
for
now that I'm
sure.
I'm like bragging about how I'm like have a, that's such a weird brag. Like, man, my frontal lobe is so formed.
So you don't even know if it's formed yet.
Yeah. I don't know. Should I get a brain scan? Just to make sure.
I don't know. Yeah, I don't know if they can tell that.
Okay.
We'll have to ask Hootie.
Okay. Yeah. Ask Hootie for us.
All right, Viv and Riley, before I let you go, we're going to do a very special edition of the Lightning Round. This game is called Which One? The answers, there's two answers, or there's a possibility of a third answer, but there's really two answers. It's either Viv or Riley. And you're
like
allowed
it.
To say your own name. I'm going to count you down 3, 2, 1, and then you say the answer.
Okay, do we both say it?
Okay.
We both say our answer.
You both say the answer. Yes.
All right.
Okay. Here we go. Lightning round, which one? Which one is the travel agent?
Riley.
3, 2, 1. You've already ruined the game.
Okay, wait. You got to give Viv. I'm sorry. I forgot about the 3, 2, 1. Because my frontal lobe is too formed. Okay.
No, that's
unfortunate. Right. Oh, my God. All right. Well, listen. Which one is the travel agent? 3, 2, 1.
Riley.
Riley. Okay. Which one is the cook? 3, 2, 1.
Viv. But, like, I'm trying.
Okay.
Riley sous chefs it up.
Sounds good. Ah, wonderful. Which one is the one that picks the movie? 3, 2, 1.
Neither. We're both really indecisive.
So
okay. Which one is the funny one? 3, 2, 1.
Viv.
Both of us. We're both funny. Sorry, I didn't do it right on one.
You're thinking about it.
That's me hanging.
Riley's funny. Riley's the funny one.
No.
Which one would rather be fishing? 3, 2, 1.
Oh, wow. Really? You want to be fishing?
I enjoy fishing.
It's true. I forgot. I forgot. I'm love so that. Sorry.
We're learning new things about each other.
You gotta go fish. You gotta go
okay,
fishing.
This is the last one. Which one believes in ghosts? 3, 2, 1.
Viv.
Ooh.
Yeah.
That's like the only consensus. Oh, in cook.
I'm not
cooking.
Yeah, Viv is a good ghost believer. She has like rocks and stuff by her bed.
Do you recharge your crystals in the moonlight?
No, not that good.
I have not done that. No.
That's why there's so many ghosts around.
You better recharge them. The full moon, the harvest moon, the red moon, the pink moon.
That's right.
You really need to protect your family, Viv.
You're so right. Thank you for this reminder.
Yeah, this is...
Yes.
This is rough.
Well, listen, we have reached the end of this interview. Imaginary People was one of the best records of 2023. If you haven't listened to it, what are you doing? Listen to it. I'm excited to see you guys again, to hang in real life, yuck it up, and watch you perform. Yes, I enjoy you both a lot.
It's so good.
Too.
Yeah, it's so good to talk to you and reunite.
This episode of Basic Folk was produced by CJ Nungesser. Our music is composed by Alex Stanton. Basic Folk is on the Bluegrass Situation Podcast Network. You can find all of our episodes there, wherever you get podcasts. You can also search for us on the SiriusXM app, or you can check out our website, basicfolk.com. If you enjoyed this episode, please share it with a friend, like maybe your favorite uncle who is an old-time fiddler who you think maybe won't like this Viv and Riley album because it's got a couple of boops and bops and some dissonant guitars, but it also has some fiddle. You never know, because he's like an open-minded guy. He like got you a Grateful Dead tape when you were in the sixth grade and also like Warriors tie-dye t-shirts pretty regularly. He could be into it. You should send it to him. Okay, well, thank you for listening all the way to the end. It's been a real pleasure, and we'll talk to you next time. Bye.